This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. As you may know, comic Mark Maron recently interviewed President Obama for an episode of WTF, Maron's podcast. Later that day, after the president and his entourage left and the Secret Service had cleared out from Maron's garage where he records the podcast, Maron spoke to Terry about the interview.
Mark, it's great to talk with you again. So you just kind of eased into the interview. It didn't like officially start at any point. You started talking as you were sitting down in your chairs. And I thought that was just like a really nice, sweet moment. I just want to play that.
So I'll bet you got like snipers on your roof and stuff.
There's snipers over there, and there's one on the roof. And you can sit in the orange chair.
Am I in the orange chair?
Orange chair for you, Mr. President.
Outstanding.
Who's staying in the room? We're doing pictures. Oh, my gosh.
This is pretty cool.
This is the place. This is where it happens.
I like this, man.
You do?
I do.
It's my whole life.
You
everything.
But you're like a big cheese now, man. You can't pretend like you're just some...
What do you mean? Can I go on pretending?
You can't pretend like you're some little guy in the garage.
Should I move?
You're not big time.
Okay, so that's President Obama in your garage doing your podcast with a sniper on your roof?
There was a sniper on the roof next door. I think that we decided it would be too noisy to have a sniper on the garage roof walking around. Though he, from what I'm told by my producer, he had such good sight lines on top of the garage, but they found that on my neighbor Dennis's roof, they were fine. So I believe there were two snipers over there. There was a bunch of LAPD on the periphery down at the bottom of the hill that I live on. There was some LAPD on my other neighbor on the other sides on their deck. And then there were Secret Service people all over the place. And there was a Secret Service guy behind me during the interview who I didn't see at all. I was so intent on focusing on the president.
Your neighbors must love you.
Well, you know, I felt bad at first, you know, and I apologized to people because they closed off the entire neighborhood. They closed off my street and a lot of the streets for the entire route, though he did fly from Santa Monica to Pasadena in a helicopter and then picked up the motorcade there as opposed to shut down the entire city. It was sort of a problem. And I that was one of the things entering this interview is I felt bad about causing people trouble traffic wise in my neighborhood. It was plaguing me a little bit. And then I'm talking to the president and the load that he carries mentally and emotionally on a day-to-day basis and what he has to compartmentalize. I sort of found strength in that. I'm like, all right, you know what? I'm going to have to let go of the idea that my neighbors are upset with me. Because quite honestly, they were thrilled. And by the time it became very public, my street was lined with people with signs welcoming the president. And I think they were a little disappointed that it wasn't a public event. But they were still excited to see the motorcade.
So Mark, how did this happen? How did President Obama end up in your garage recording an interview for your podcast?
I know it's crazy. What happened was months ago, you know, quite a few months ago, the White House reached out with an idea. There was a fan in his staff of my show and thought it would be a fun idea, an idea that the president would do my show. And that was shared with my producer, Brendan. And he said to me that the White House called. I'm like, all right, well, that's fine. But come on, he's not going to do my show. And I just didn't think of that it would ever happen. I would never think to necessarily try to get the president on the show. I don't really do a political show anymore, and I wouldn't think the president would necessarily want to do my podcast. But I just never thought about it. And then all of a sudden, here it was, and I was like, well, it's not going to happen. And then as months went by, it was like, well, they called again, and it's going to happen probably. And I'm like, well, what do I do? Do I go to the Washington? Do I go to his hotel? What happens? And Brendan says, well, they said they want to do it at the garage. I'm like, that's insane. So you're telling the president's just going to come over to my house, my two-bedroom, one-bathroom house, and sit in my broken-down garage? But where everybody sits, it is the place where it happens. But I just couldn't even wrap my brain around it.
I'm assuming the president knows that the title of your podcast is WTF. And that you say all the words that stands for at the beginning of every podcast. That would scare away most presidents.
You know, out of respect, and I think out of I'm foregoing that at the beginning of this episode, and while I was with the president, I'm happy to report that I did not drop any F-bombs or say any bad words, which is amazing for me, really. But I think innately I know when that's appropriate.
I thought you did such a nice job of having like comedic touches in the interview, but getting to serious things with him.
Yeah, I was worried about that. You know, I probably could have got a few more laughs, but it just wasn't. It was not the focus of my interview, was to make the president laugh. I think I got a couple of good ones, and I think I engaged him well. I felt I know there were a couple of moments where we had real connection, but whether or not he felt that, I don't know. But I felt it, and that was very exciting for me that I could see him as a person. It did not, during the entire interview, once we got started, I was never like, oh, my God, it's the president of the United States. What's he doing here? It was like, this is a guy I'm talking to, which is all I really hope for. I don't know if you can hear that, but that's how I felt.
Did you have to worry about, like, what am I going to wear in meeting the president? I always wear, like,
a plaid shirt
or something. You wore your plaid shirt.
I did. Yeah, I just wore a plaid shirt. What am I going to put a tie on? The amazing thing is I drive myself crazy. I was actually panicked that we would run out of things to talk about. See, that's how crazy I am. I'm like, well, I got these first few questions and these areas that I want to talk about. But what if we're 10 minutes in and I got nothing else? You know, with that guy, what are you kidding me? You know, how is it? You know, like, I just don't know. My big fear was, am I going to be able to engage, you know, honestly and in a real way with the president of the United States? And like, you hear it in that clip you played earlier, right when he gets there, you know, he puts me at ease.
Well, here's another example of that. You're talking to him about how when he was in college, he lived a couple of blocks away from where you live now, or from where the garage is where you do your podcast.
Yeah.
And so you got him talking about that and, you know, what it was like for him to be a couple of blocks away from where he went to college, and here's how that played out.
I want to, you know, before, like, I feel like we jumped right into the conversation, which is good.
It was quick.
And I'm honored that you came, it's an amazing privilege for me to talk to you.
Listen, I'm a big fan, and you know, I love conversations like this, because, you know, if I thought to myself that when I was in college that I'd be in a garage,
yeah,
a couple miles away from where I was living,
yeah,
doing an interview
as president
with a comedian. I think that's a pretty hard scenario to
couldn't imagine it.
It's not possible to imagine.
No,
I think it's hysterical. He's talking about how he couldn't imagine it.
Yeah,
I think you're the one who probably couldn't imagine it.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, he's like, yeah, he's pretty amazing. He's a pretty amazing person in terms of it's always interesting when you meet people who have a sort of personal power or magic, you know, of any kind. It's a rare thing, you know, when because you read about the president, or you see people's reactions to the president, or you have whatever your feelings are about the president on a day to day basis, like, you know, oh, there's the president again, or what, you take certain things for granted. But to really sort of, you know, be in the presence of somebody who is the president and has been for 8 years, and to wonder what is that gift? How does just a person do that? And to feel the incredible sort of charisma and ease at which this guy handles himself. And I'm completely honest with you. You know, I was a bit of a nervous wreck, and he immediately, you know, put me at ease. I don't know how. I'm not easy to put at ease. You know, I'm a nutbag. I'm crazy, you know, a little bit. And I felt like, thank God, you know, he did that so I could have a good conversation with him, you know.
My house is a mess. I can't imagine having the president over to my house. Not that he's interested in coming, but what did you have to do?
I know about your house.
Yes.
I know about your house, Terry. I know about the records.
The records, the vinyl. Mm-hmm. What did you have to do to get your garage in order so that you thought it was fit for President Obama?
Well, I have a lot of clutter on the desk, and the Secret Service certainly helped me with that. They came in. Like,
yeah, right.
I have a pocket knife on my desk. I have a, like, half a hammer, like this weird hammer that's broken. That,
oh, the
just
pocket knife was just in an episode of your show.
Right. I think it might have been that knife. But like, and apparently when Brendan was walking them through when I was out of town, they're like, yeah, the knife and the hammer got to go.
Yeah.
So
those
got to go. And there was a lot of boxes of clutter on the floor, stacks of books, a lot of, I imagine, what your house looks like. And and we had to move them out. And it was really interesting because apparently it was about, we don't want anything that he can trip over, and we don't want any obstacles in the way. We had to clear out the entire driveway of everything and clear out anything in the pathway of the president's walk. So they helped out a lot with that. My amp had to go. The guitars had to go. We had to declutter the garage. But it was, everything was still intact. It was just the stuff that was sort of loose and on the floor and the stuff that could be construed as dangerous on the desk that had to go. And it looked pretty clean.
You and I are the same, I think, in not wanting to have anyone in the studio or the garage in your case beyond the person who we're interviewing. And like, for me, it's because, like, I don't want my guest picking up on anyone else's vibe. I just want them in their own head responding to what we're talking about. And I don't want to be picking up on the vibe of their publicist or their manager or their spouse or anyone else. You know, I don't want to be thinking, look, what's this third party thinking about my questions? So when the Secret Service person had to be in the garage with you and you wanted to get rid of basically everybody except for one Secret Service person, how did you tell them that they had to leave?
Well, I think it was an understanding. I was happy there weren't more people in, because there was some talk that maybe a staffer would be in or that two Secret Service would be in. And also, it's interesting because I might have learned something interviewing you in a public way, that we did our conversation in front of people, that there is a way to focus, despite the fact that there were at least six people on my deck next to the garage with headphones on, listening to the interview. And one of them was archiving it for the White House. And one of them was a staffer. One of them was Brendan, my producer. And then there was other people who were out there. So, and there was Secret Service all over the place. And Secret Service are pretty good at being invisible. So I didn't even feel that guy's presence. And also, there is something inside you. And it was something that the president actually spoke to around, doing something enough. That where I wanted just to make sure that all I was focused on and listening to and seeing was him. And that happened. Even, I think, at another point in my life, I would have made myself crazy knowing there was five people listening to it and that there was a guy standing behind me and that my windows had to be taped up and there was a sniper on there.
Wait, your windows had to be taped up?
That was the one. The one thing that they left to me and Brendan for some reason is that they got a sniper or two on the roof next to us, but there were still sight lines. There's a window that goes right out to my neighbor's yard, and then there's one that goes right out to my backyard. And the Secret Service they said that, yeah, you got to put some garbage bags on those. You got to tape some garbage bags. So the day before the interview, I was up on a ladder because the back part of my garage is about 20 feet up, and up on the roof of my garage, duct taping garbage bags to my windows so the president wouldn't be in the sight line of any potential snipers while in my garage. So it was a hands-on thing for me. I was very active in that.
So we had talked about this once before. Like, what happens when the interview's over? Like, you talked about this in the
comment. I cried.
Did you really?
Yeah. A little bit, right in front of Brendan. It was a weird moment for us, but he handled it pretty well. like they all left, and the Secret Service was still getting their stuff together. And I'm walking out of the garage, and I was just like, "Oh God!" And I just started crying a little bit, and I was like hiding it from Brendan. I was like, because he was just standing in front of me talking to me, and I was like holding my eyes, and I was just like, my voice was cracking. He's like, "What are you just like? He's just letting it out," and I'm like, yeah, man, I don't know what it is. I'm just overwhelmed with emotion. I pulled it together pretty quickly. But yeah, I felt that. And then I felt like, and then I was like, was it all right? Was it all right? Did we do it? Did it happen? Was it okay? Because this is why it's hard. Because I don't know, sometimes. I know this is the president, but he is, the best of the politicians. These are politicians. I don't know sometimes, what I got and if it hasn't been said before, or if I got, steamrolled somehow, or I got sort of taken off track. I don't know any of that stuff. And I just didn't want to second guess it. But he said it was great. And I think it felt great to me. And I just have to learn how to sort of do what the president does and kind of just let it be its thing now and be OK with it.
So you know how you said that you were in tears when it was over? Mm-hmm. This is something like I know you've teared up in other interviews too.
It's happening a lot lately.
So here's something I really want to understand about you. How is it that the Marc Maron that you portray on your IFC TV series Maron is a guy who's really aggravating? Do you know what I mean? He's kind of abrupt to people. He has real like anger management issues. He's very kind of self-centered, very much in his own head. Not a lot of empathy or sympathy for other people. But the Maron who I hear on your podcast, the Maron who I met when you interviewed me, is this really empathetic person who is capable of tearing up and who seems just exceptionally interested in what the people who you're talking to have to say. You seem to really want to know about them. So why is the persona that you have on TV so like radically different from the person who you are on the podcast? Which isn't to say that, I mean, you're very funny in both settings. So like that's definitely a commonality.
But why? I think that was an older version of me. And I think that having not known, really how to go about, creating a persona of myself on television, that sort of seemed to be how it evolved. And I was obviously, 100% part of that. And it really became, especially this season, where we see this sort of full, the well-rounded comic character of that Marc Maron. I think it's sort of representational of me, probably a decade ago. And because I needed to find something organic within my personality that could live on that screen, but also to be funny. I think it's a little easier to write for that guy, to be funny and to be sort of a bit more of a victim of himself. But I think that is an old, less evolved Marc Maron, a less humbled by time, and also a Marc Maron with less self esteem that came through validation of doing the work that I've been doing. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how it really serves me in the big picture, other than to be a comedic character and to try to explore the way that I made mistakes. And people seem to like it for that reason. But there is a difference. I don't think he's fundamentally not me, but I do think he's a more immature me and somebody who is not as onto his psychological and emotional issues as I have become in more recent years.
So I want to get back to the Obama interview for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
You've said, and I started to ask you this before, you said in your interview with Conan O'Brien a long time ago. So what happens when the interview ends? Do you like have a cup of coffee together? Do you go out, have a sandwich? Do you hang out and schmooze a little bit more in your garage? Do you invite them into your actual house? So when the interview was over with President Obama, was that like it? Did it like when the recording was turned off, was it over? Did you schmooze some more afterwards and talk about the interview, reminisce about how it went, ask him other questions?
Yeah. Yeah, no, he was like, he was very concerned about how it went for me. And I said, I think it went great. And I go, how'd it go for you? He goes, it was good. It was good. And he said it was a little intense at the start. And then we went outside and he took pictures with me and he took pictures with my producer Brendan, and we did a selfie, and then one of his staff brought a book, a children's book, from apparently a little kid was next door across the street and wanted him to sign it, and he signed that. And I said, "So what happens now?" And I got my arm on his back. Where are you going? I don't know. I felt like I was touching him for a long time, and then and they said, "Well, I gotta get the plane. I'm going up to San Francisco to do a fundraiser." And then all of a sudden, a crew of people came and they started disassembling the tents that were on my driveway. And then all the Secret Service stuff got their stuff, and they just like were gone. It was all gone. And I let my cats out of the bedroom. And they're like, "What's up? Are we good?" And I'm like, "How you doing?" And they were like, "Okay, is everyone gone? Can we have our house back, please?" And then now it's back to life.
So I'd like to end with another part of the interview that you recorded with the president. And this is a part where you said something like, so when Michelle says to you, okay, that's enough, what's she talking about? And he started talking about, you know, their relationship and when they were dating and about how she'd be really angry with him when he'd show up 15 minutes late, which he often would.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just going to pick it up from there because it's just a really, really nice story.
You know, like when she goes, like if Michelle says, would you stop that, please? What is she talking about? Do you like
well,
it?
Well, I mean, they're being late.
Yeah. Do you isolate? Like, for some reason, I see you as a guy that's sort of like in your head and just sort of like, you know, we'll just detach a little bit.
No. I'm very engaged. That's not. She will say stop that. When we first started dating, yeah. And I'd always give myself kind of a 15-minute leeway,
right?
In terms of showing up,
okay,
and getting to stuff, and partly because Michelle's dad had multiple sclerosis.
Mm.
It's really interesting. I used to say, you know, why are you stressing me about, you know, being late?
Yeah.
I'm just 15 minutes late, 10 minutes late. What's the big deal? And then I don't remember how long we were in the relationship when she described how her dad had to wake up an hour earlier than everybody else because he had multiple sclerosis just to put on his shirt and button his own shirt. Was a big task,
right?
And if the family wanted to go see Michelle's brother play basketball, mm-hmm. This is before the ADA, the American Disabilities mm-hmm. Act. You know, they'd have to get there early
mm-hmm.
so that her dad, on crutches, could hobble his way up the stairs to their seat, and that mentality of not wanting to stand out and not wanting to, you know, miss something had instilled in her. So it was a very emotional thing.
It was loaded.
Right?
It wasn't just about being late.
Well, Mark, I really thought you did a terrific job with the president. It's got some funny moments. It's got some really sweet moments. It's got some very interesting moments about his life as president and about the kinds of decisions he has to make, about the political divisions in America, about racial issues. You really cover a lot of stuff. I just found it very, like, totally engrossing. So congratulations.
Thank you, Terry. That means a lot to me.
Comedian Mark Maron speaking with Terry Gross after Maron's interview with President Obama. The episode of Maron's podcast, WTF, with the Obama interview, was released last Monday. Everyone generally agrees that libraries are good things, right? But the purpose of libraries, even their physical existence, is no longer a given in our digital age. A new book called Patience and Fortitude spotlights the recent fight over the fate of one of America's most famous and beloved libraries. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has this review.
Since it opened in 1911, the building has become a New York City landmark, praised not only for its beauty, but also for its functional brilliance. In the words of one contemporary architect, the main branch of the New York Public Library at Fifth Avenue and 42nd Street is a perfect machine for reading. The Grand Reading Room sits atop 7 levels of iron and steel book stacks, whose contents could, at one time, be delivered to anybody who requested a book within a matter of minutes via a small elevator. Those stacks also support the floor of the reading room above. Financial support for the New York Public Library, however, was never as firm as its structural underpinnings. In a gripping new book called Patience and Fortitude, the title, of course, derives from the names of the two iconic lions that guard the library's entrance, reporter Scott Sherman details how bottom-line business logic nearly gutted one of the world's greatest public research libraries. His slim, smart book is packed with a colorful cast of moguls, celebrities, intellectuals, and internet crusaders, and it springs from a series of cover stories about the library that Sherman wrote for The Nation magazine starting in 2011. patience and fortitude not only tells a classic New York story about real estate and money, but also shines a light on why libraries as physical repositories for books are still crucial, even in an age where all knowledge seems just a keyboard click away. In part, the crisis over the New York Public Library stems from the fact that it's a weird entity. It's not a state or city agency. Instead, the library was founded as a private, nonprofit institution. It's always been governed by a board of trustees typically drawn from Manhattan's 1%. In 2007, that board decided to build up the library's coffers by selling off other Midtown libraries under its control and by clearing the stacks of the 42nd Street Library of its 3 million books, which would be transferred to a storage facility in New Jersey. The landmark New York Public Library building would then undergo a modernization. Sherman says that what the trustees saw as updating for the digital age, critics saw as nothing more than a series of tawdry real estate deals, which would result in a nightmare vision of a hollowed-out library where patrons could sit, sip coffee, and read digitized books on their e-readers. Those critics were at first composed of a small band of writers, scholars, and preservationists, easily dismissed as elitists. After articles about the library plan by Sherman and other journalists began to appear, however, masses of New Yorkers, along with celebrities like Al Sharpton, Gloria Steinem, and Salman Rushdie, piled in. The late eminent architecture critic Ada Louise Huxtable deserves special mention as a heroic voice of the opposition forces. Sherman says Huxtable was 91 and in failing health when the controversy erupted. Stonewalled by library officials when she initially tried to research the renovation plans, Huxtable persevered and wrote an excoriating essay for the Wall Street Journal in 2012. Responding to the library officials' argument that modernization was needed because only 6% of print sources were being read every year by patrons, Huxtable said, "If we could estimate how many ways in which the world has been changed by that 6%, the number would be far more meaningful than the traffic through the library's lion-guarded doors." A research library is a timeless repository of treasures, not a popularity contest measured by headcounts, the current arbiter of success. Huxtable died a month after publishing what Sherman dubs this thunderbolt of an essay. It's a passionate defense of the New York Public Library, but also by extension, it's a defense of reading, the humanities, and all those other things whose value can't be measured by Facebook likes or dollar signs. Last year, the library renovation plan was defeated. But as Sherman reminds his readers, the future is still uncertain. The library's famous stacks may still stand, but they're empty. The 3 million books that were sent to New Jersey haven't been returned, and some are now missing. Sherman's charged account of the battle over the library is a shock to the system, alerting his readers to the dangers of indifference. In addition to patience and fortitude, the New York Public Library, like libraries everywhere, could probably use a third guardian lion called vigilance.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. It's now out in paperback. She reviewed Patience and Fortitude by Scott Sherman. If you had the artistic talent to create impressive paintings or sculpture, could you imagine devoting that skill to copying the work of past artists and trying to pass your creations off as authentic? Our guest art scholar Noah Charney says you'd be surprised how many people have done just that over the years, some successfully selling hundreds of fakes as the real thing. You'd also be surprised, he says, at how many art forgers want to get caught. so they can embarrass the art world that wasn't interested in their original work but was too dim to tell forgeries from true masterpieces. Charney's new book is an absorbing look at the techniques, colorful characters, and consequences of art forgery dating back to the Renaissance. Noah Charney's an art historian and writer, and founder and president of the Association for Research into Crimes Against Art, a nonprofit research group devoted to issues of art crime. He's written numerous articles and a novel called The Art Thief. His new book is The Art of Forgery. Well, Noah Charney, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, I learned from your book that it was really only around the Renaissance that art collecting in the modern sense developed, and that before that, people cared about works of art more for what they were than for their origin. And one of the best stories of forgery involves the famous Michelangelo, who was not copied. He was the forger. Tell us what happened.
It's an amazing true story because most people don't realize that Michelangelo began his career as a forger of ancient Roman sculptures. And that was at a time in the Renaissance when an ancient Roman sculpture was far more valuable than a work made a few weeks ago by this character, Michelangelo Buonarroti, who no one had ever heard of. And so he, in cahoots with an art dealer, contrived to make a marble sculpture called Sleeping Eros, and it was buried in a garden and dug up, broken, repaired, and sold as an antiquity to a cardinal who was an expert in antiquities and should probably have known better. But the cardinal, after a few years, started to get suspicious and tried to return the sculpture to the dealer. But by this time, Michelangelo was the most famous sculptor in Rome, so the dealer was very happy to take the sculpture back, and he sold it very easily on as now a Michelangelo original.
So essentially, the forgery was discovered. Did it damage his reputation?
To the contrary, it was actually embellished it, and Michelangelo was the first to admit this story because in order to demonstrate his capability as a great artist, artists have always copied the art of past periods. And artists studying with a master in their studio, their job would be to replicate the master's style as closely as possible so that you really couldn't tell the difference. And it only becomes a problem if you try to pass off the work you create as the work of someone else, and you could commit the crime of fraud. But even to this day, there's no crime called forgery. Forgers commit crime of economic fraud, but it's no problem to copy or to imitate another artist's style.
You know, today there are a lot of scientific tests that can help you determine at least the age of a painting and some other relevant information. But in the past, people relied on experts, art connoisseurs, to help authenticate works of art. What kind of expertise did they bring, and how reliable was it?
One of the odd things about the art world is that there has never been any objective determination of expertise in a specific period or artist. You could have a PhD or even two in Rembrandt, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you can identify a Rembrandt from a copy after Rembrandt or something done by someone in his studio. In the world of wine, you need to go through elaborate steps to become a master of wine over many years and fulfill these objective tests. The art world doesn't have that. So expertise has always been a matter of personal opinion, and it's been quite subjective. It's very unscientific. And yet for centuries, expertise has been the primary way to authenticate something. The secondary way is provenance research, looking into the documented history of the object. But knowing this, criminals can insert themselves into the history of the object and pass off forgeries with remarkable ease because the art world, unfortunately, is often inadvertently complicit in authenticating forgeries.
Right. So some connoisseurs got quite famous for doing what they were doing, but there are many cases where they were just fooled, right?
There were a lot of cases where they're just fooled, and even extremely knowledgeable experts get fooled now and then. It's a sort of trap that the most successful forgers plant in order to ensnare experts. And the best of the forgers, it's the confidence trick rather than the object itself that convinces. You look at a lot of these pieces in a vacuum and you wonder, how was anyone fooled by this? But the confidence trick and various renditions of what I call a provenance trap is what really authenticates these pieces.
What are some of the physical things, apart from the quality of the art itself, that would look for in a painting to help determine its authenticity?
Well, it depends on the type of painting. But if we're talking about an oil painting, one of the things that has to be replicated in order for it to appear old is called crackler. And crackler is the web of cracks that appears naturally in oil paint over time as it expands and contracts. And it literally looks like little webbing on the surface. And you can study that and you can determine whether it was artificially induced to make it look old quickly or whether it appeared naturally. And there are various tricks to try to make it appear that it was old when it was artificially induced, but that's usually a good clue for oil paintings.
How do you recreate crackler?
Well, we actually have some accounts voluntarily presented by famous forgers for their own recipes for how to make forgeries. And a handful of the forgers in the book volunteered themselves. They were never caught because they wanted the notoriety. And one of them is Eric Hebern, who I would argue was at the same artistic skill level as the people he imitated. And he published a book called The Art Forger's Handbook, which was literally, it was like a cookbook of recipes for how to create forgeries and artificially age them. And one of the techniques is to take an oil paint and cover it in a shortening, like Crisco or Bakelite, and you literally bake it in an oven at a certain temperature for a certain amount of time, and it artificially induces something that looks like crackler. He also explained how you could paint on crackler, which is very painstaking, but he was able to successfully pull it off.
What else? Labels, inscriptions on frames or on the material that it's painted on?
Well, it's very important to look at the back of objects, particularly paintings and prints, and there's a lot of information on the back that people tend not to look at. Things like old auction stamps. There might be information on the support itself, where the canvas was purchased. These sort of details are very important, but people tend to look at the front of a painting but not turn it over. They're particularly loath to take something out of its frame if it's nicely matted and framed, and this you really need to do, especially if you're buying, for instance, 20th century lithographs. Those are the most frequently forged objects in all of art, and unfortunately, laser printers and Photoshop, you can forge these without any artistic skill thanks to computers. And if it's matted up and framed, you can't tell a lot about it, and it's very difficult to distinguish a lithograph from something that was printed out a few weeks ago. So it's important to take things out of the frame and look at the back and see if there are any markings that suggest age and suggest the origin of the object.
And wormholes tell a story?
Wormholes do tell a story, and that is one of the most difficult things to reproduce. These are literally holes that tiny insects can make, and they're irregular. They squirm around, and they eat their way through paper or panel. And it's incredibly difficult to do anything that is that organic and irregular if you're trying to reproduce it with mechanical tools. So that is one of the best ways to try to age something. But there are forgers who have shot panels with buckshot to try to replicate the holes, but then you'll have the holes on the surface, but they won't curve around organically as if a worm had made them. So for each tool of a forger, there's a way that we can spot it. But the trick is really that it rarely gets to the point of in-depth analysis or even forensic testing. The nature of the art trade is such that if it looks pretty good and experts agree on it, and if the provenance, the documented history, looks good, then nobody bothers with the scientific testing. And it probably shouldn't be that way, but it's been that way for a very long time.
And when a forger actually paints a work of art intended to look like that of a master, can you tell a difference in brushstrokes?
Yes, you usually can. And brushstroke analysis is one of the tools that experts will use and that scientists can use too, although science is rather late in coming to the analysis and authentication of works of art. It tends to be more mystical than that. The great scholar Walter Benjamin wrote a famous article that said, we don't understand why great art is great, but it has some sort of aura that people respond to. And the shorthand is that if we could scientifically explain away what we found beautiful or moving about it, then it would sort of detract from the mysticism of it. And in terms of authenticating things, it's a lot down to personal opinion of experts. They'll look at brush strokes, but you know, within any one artist's oeuvre, their style might change. They might have had a funny day. They aren't always exactly the same when they paint. And so finding brushstrokes that look a bit different isn't a specific determination that it's a forgery. There are lots of works that are copies after original works. There are works that were made by people in the studio of the master with the master's supervision. that are almost certainly sanctioned by the master, but they're not originals. And it wasn't long ago that at Museo del Prado in Madrid, they found a Mona Lisa that looked just like the original, and they would have said it's a copy after the Mona Lisa, except that it had underdrawings that matched the original, which suggests that the concept of it was developed alongside the original, and it was almost certainly painted by one of Leonardo's pupils alongside the original while he was painting it.
So in a case like that, where there's a studio system, the master supervises students who are copying a work, that work gets out into the art world. How different is that from a work by the master?
It's a great question because we tend to think of artists as individuals creating the work of art in their entirety. And that is not the way it has been for many centuries. That's a very romantic notion of how art is created. And in fact, centuries-long process is the studio system. And all of the great old masters ran art studios. And depending on how much you paid them, they would create themselves a relevant proportion of the work of art. So if you want a Rubens, for example, you pay him the maximum amount, then he paints everything himself and he designs it too. You pay him the minimum, it's still called a Rubens, but he supervises and designs the object, but it might be entirely painted by his pupils. And in practice, it's usually a mixture. Faces, eyes, and hands are almost always done by the master because they're considered the more difficult if you're talking about portraits. But backgrounds, architectural elements, still lifes, those were almost never painted by the master, and yet anything coming out of the master's studio is considered the work of Rubens. So when people get upset about artists like Jeff Koons and Damien Hirst, who design works and supervise it, but they have a team of people in a factory making it for them, that's actually in keeping with a centuries-old artistic tradition.
You write that a lot of forgers are artists who didn't quite succeed in their independent careers. And so they took to forgery in part to get back at the art world that rejected them. I love this phrase of yours, revenge is a dish best served at auction. And there are a lot of examples of this. Eric Hebron is among the most famous. What got him into forgery?
Eric Hebron is an example of the majority of forgers that I look at, and they do fit this psychological profile. He was a failed original artist, and he decided he was going to get back at the art world that rejected his original creations, but he had a more specific origin story. He had been at a flea market, and he spotted what he thought were some good drawings, and he bought them, and he brought them to a gallery called Colnaghi in London. And the people there said, yeah, these are pretty good. You got a good eye. We'll take them off your hands. And he doubled his money, so he was quite pleased. But then a few weeks later, he was walking past the gallery, and he saw those drawings in the window for thousands of pounds. And he felt that he had been ripped off by these sort of stuffy gallerists, and he decided he was going to get back at them.
Well, was that and because they recognized that they were the authentic works of masters? Or, I mean, did they just know more than he did?
They just knew more than he did. And of course, this happens. If you run a gallery, your job is to buy works of art that you think are maybe undervalued and sell them at a profit. But he felt that he was being taken advantage of, and he decided that he was going to take advantage of them in return.
So what did he do?
Well, he started out by creating drawings that appear to be preparatory sketches for famous paintings. And this is a very clever idea. And what he was doing was creating lost works. And you may know that for pre-modern artists, we usually know of many more works than are extant than we can identify. And in some cases, for old masters, Renaissance, medieval artists, as much as two-thirds of their oeuvre is missing, lost. And there's always hope that objects might resurface. And Eric Hebron was creating objects that match this description. His trick was to choose a famous painting and to create a drawing that looked like a preparatory sketch for it. And the reason that drawings don't often survive is that it's a recent concept that drawings are collectible. For most of the history of art, drawings were made as a preparation for the final. They're like blueprints. You keep the building, but you might not necessarily keep the blueprints. And so every once in a while these drawings resurface, but it's only recently that they were considered something collectible to display on your wall. So it's very clever of him to choose something that we know existed, we don't have examples of it, and so he's creating a work of art that functions as a piece of provenance.
And how successful was he? How many forgeries did he manage to sell?
He was hugely successful, and he's really the most skillful and the most passionate about his art. And he's one of the few forgers who created works that were forensically identical to the originals. And now most forgers don't need to do that, because if it looks good and if the provenance trap is convincing, if the story is convincing enough, then nobody bothers with scientific testing. But he created at least 1,000 forgeries, probably more than that. And there are probably some of his works sitting on gallery walls, and we just don't know.
And when you say they're forensically identical, did you say, to the originals? What do you mean?
They are. Let me give you some examples, and we know in detail because he very helpfully wrote a book called The Art Forger's Handbook, which has been found in the studio of many forgers arrested since it came out, and he gives recipes for how to make forgeries. So, for example, he would buy early modern books to reuse pieces of paper from it to create early modern drawings, so that if the paper was tested forensically, it would date to the right era. He would also create his own inks. For example, there's a type of ink called oak gall, and it's acidic. So if you make a drawing with this oak gall ink and it sits on paper for long enough, it will slowly start to erode the paper and it'll have little grooves where the lines are. And he knows this, and so he says if you want to make oak gall drawing that looks 500 years old, you're going to need to dip your quill in sulfuric acid and trace your lines so that it eats away at the paper. So an expert will see these grooves and it will suggest the age of the presence of this ink on the page. That level of detail is astounding to me, and I appreciate from an art history standpoint that he would have that level of detail and passion for his subject.
Well, Noah Charney, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Noah Charney is an art historian and writer and founder of the Association for Research into Crimes Against Art. His new book is The Art of Forgery. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.